So if we keep good pace, the last sort of 15 minutes of today will be talking about all the mysteries of this W mass, because of all the measurements that we do in the world, it's certainly the one that's causing the most headaches right now. I mean, good sort of headaches, but also bad sort of headaches. First, I want to talk a little bit more about the Z boson. First of all, because I love the Z boson. It's really beautiful. The Z boson is like your favorite dog in the sense that you love it. It's beautiful. It does wonderful things. You'll see the Z boson being incredibly useful for many other things, and yet it still brings surprises. It was studied very well in the LEP days. I was on the OPAL experiment. We did a lot of measurements of Z boson, and yet even now at the LHC, we are making amazing measurements of the Z boson that far surpass even the LEP era. And the reason we can do that is because we have tons of them. We produce a lot of them. All right, so we're going to look at Z boson production for its own sake and also for the sake of other measurements. So if you want to produce a Z boson, you need to have a quark-antiquark pair, which you come from, you know, one from each of the protons. And then poof, out of that comes a Z boson, which doesn't hang around terribly long, as we saw from yesterday. And this is a very, very slow motion video, and then decays to two particles. Mostly we use the leptonic decays of the Z boson for experimental reasons. First of all, it's quite easy to fully reconstruct the Z boson decay. The other thing is that they're very easy to trigger on. The experiment is very likely to open up and take data if it sees two leptons, as opposed to Z boson decaying to, say, a quark-antiquark pair. A quark-antiquark pair can come from many things, and it's more difficult to just know that it's from the Z boson. All right, at Born level, a Z boson is actually rather uninteresting. You know, here's my proton, here's another proton. Some quarks interact, out comes Z boson, and it has no transverse momentum, so I have no chance really of seeing it in my experiment because it just keeps going down the beam line. Now it gets more interesting now at order alphas when you start having the production here of quarks and gluons. So here are some of the diagrams here, annihilation and Compton, because this gives my Z boson a transverse momentum, so I can start seeing it in my experiment. And then the value of the transverse momentum tells you something about what happened here in the hard scattering. Before I tell you about what we do with the Z boson today, I want to motivate to you why the Z boson is so interesting to us, even for searches for new particles. This is something that we could do very early on in ATLAS. We can't really do this anymore because we count so many particles that we don't even look at this part of the phase space anymore. But if you look at the production of two muons, a mu plus and a mu minus, you build the invariant mass of a mu plus and mu minus, and you say, does it come from a common particle, such as the Z? You would see here, indeed, here's your Z boson at 91 GeV. But if you start going to lower invariant masses, you see also kinds of neat other resonances, which you may not be familiar with, but certainly maybe in the 50s and 60s, this is what all the hot physics in those days. You can produce omegas, rhos, phis, J size. Remember J size? I mentioned it last time or yesterday. That's another one of our standard candles. J size and the Zs are our two standard candles for calibrating electrons and muons. And then there are a few other resonances. And then if you see a plot like this, your first question is, hey, if I could go further down, maybe this is not the last resonance, not the last particle that standard model provides, for example, producing a mu plus and a mu minus. So the question is, if you could go far enough down here, maybe there are new particles decaying to a mu plus and a mu minus. So we do that. This is this plot here. Now, this plot picks up just where this plot is at the Z boson. So the Z boson is, here's the red boson, Z boson right here. There's that little peak. Now there's considerably more data. This was 40 inverse picobarns, This is 36 inverse femtobarns. And then this is what this falling slope looks like when you have lots more data. Here it is. In blue, you have the production of a Z boson. In red and yellows, these are other standard model mechanisms that can mimic a Z boson. We have the ratio of what you measure to the standard model. First of all, this is like, we've measured seven orders of magnitude in a plot like this, and it is like bang on. Right now, right up to the TV scale, the ratio is one. These little peaks here, this is what it would look like if, for example, you had a beyond the standard model mechanism, for example, production of a Z prime, if it had a mass of 3 TeV, 4 TeV, or 5 TeV, this is where you would see little peaks appearing, just like you see peaks appearing in these ones. So whenever we have a new data set or we go to a new energy, this is basically the first plot we make because it's very easy to make. You're just looking for two muons or two electrons. And so we always trying to fill sort of this space here. Now we looked for it, and unfortunately we haven't seen it. And I think our range now is a few TeV. All right, so what can Z production tell us about? It's quite a nice production and decay. If you think about it, if you look at what's happening here, via the hard scatter, you could test perturbative QCD in the absence of color flow between the initial and the final states. So it's quite a clean. The Z, and we're talking about this a bit more, the Z balances the hadronic system. So basically the information here, so conservation energy momentum, is balanced out by what is produced in terms of the hadrons in this direction. We have predictions, I think, at least at NQBLO these days. Because, of course, the Z comes from quarks that comes from protons. We saw this equation yesterday. It tells us something about parton distribution functions, and that's one of the subjects of today. In fact, right away, let's go into parton distribution functions. Okay, let's look at Z production. You need a quark-antiquark pair, you know, like a quark or an antiquark, one coming from each of the protons to produce a Z0. That could be a UU bar or a DD bar or an SS bar, and even the heavier ones. You can see here the relative contributions of each type of quark to the production of the Z boson. So this is rapidity, Y. Overall, in black is the sum of all of them. And then you can see that if it's UU bar, you have in red, and DD bar in green. So already you can see they have a difference in shape. So you have sensitivity to the two, right, just by looking at the shape. More importantly for us is that the strange quark distribution, the strangeness of the proton is something that's not terribly well understood. And you can see that you have access to it by measuring the Z boson production. On this side here is a similar idea, but now we're producing a W plus. So for W plus, you have a plus charge, so you need to pick up a U quark from the proton and a D bar quark from the other proton. And you can see the various contributions to the production of a W plus. Here, really, it's very much dominated by this UD bar. And in red, you have a little bit of sensitivity, actually, to charm and strange, and to the other ones, very little. And depending on whether you're looking at W plus production or W minus production, you see the shapes are different. And between these shape differences, you actually end up having quite some sensitivity, in this case, to valence quarks. One big difference between the Tevatron, remember the Tevatron was a PP bar machine? LHC is a PP machine, is W plus production dominates over W minus at the LHC just by counting valence quarks. You have a proton with two valence U's and one valence D hitting against each other. But at the Tevatron, you have a P and a P bar. And so the number of W plus and W minus are very similar in the production at Tevatron. So as I mentioned, the W production constrains information about valence quarks in particular, and Z production provides a sensitivity to the strange quark. So how do you get that information? I mean, we look, just eyeballing, you can see there's some sensitivity. So the question is, how do you extract that into something that is measurable and quantifiable? So here again is the plot that I just showed you here for the Z and here for the W. So what you do is you use multiple production mechanisms. So you use, in this case, W's and Z's. You can also even use, for example, W produced with a charm quark to get sensitivity to charm. And then you parameterize this in terms of Parton distribution functions. So it's your prejudice in some sense to how you think the quarks are distributed within the proton. And you feed in this information. And from that, you can extract what are the best values that are consistent with the data that you see. I want to show you one plot just to show you how powerful this is. This is a plot where we're testing the relationship between the strange and the light C. So S, S bar, and U bar, D bar. In blue is what you would get out of this if you just used, if you didn't use W and Z information. You just used other information, for example, information from Hera, as we saw a little while ago. This is the constraint that you would have on this ratio. And in red is what you have just by adding the W and Z information. So you can see that you really are significantly constraining the shape of the strange distribution, whereas before you didn't. So it's very powerful. I just showed you here stuff that Atlas is doing. Far better to have you use all the world data, anything that can have any kind of sensitivity to PDFs, from Atlas, from CMS, from previous colliders, for example, from Hera at DAISY. And you want to put it all in a big soup. And then you have parameterizations, and you try to extract the Parton distribution functions. So a reminder then, Hera did this kind of, so did this deep elastic scattering. So you had an electron scattering off of the proton. And it did neutral current and charge current. So neutral current is you start with an electron and you end with an electron. And so you're exchanging in here a Z or a gamma. And the neutral current is, the charge current is when you have an electron that goes into a neutrino and you're exchanging a W. And you can see from this plot here that you are stronger actually by adding all of these other experiments. So here is the kinematic range of Hera in terms of X, right? That's the fraction of the momentum carried by the parton, the Q squared of the interaction. Here is Hera. Here are fixed target experiments from the past where literally you had a fixed target. You would just throw particles on a fixed target. And so you can see now what the LHE brings into all of this. I just mentioned a moment ago what you gain by adding W's and Z's. So W's and Z's, you would gain information about at X is about between 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 3, and Q squared is about 10 to the 4. But of course, if you go to higher energies, you could add TT bars, because TT bar being produced at the LHC comes from proton collisions, so you have access to the parton distribution functions. If you go to much lower Q squared, you could add these nice resonances like I showed you before, the J psi. You can also have BB bar. And here is also the range of Tevatron. Remember the 2GV PP bar machine? Its kinematic coverage is this here. And so really, if you want to get full picture of parton distribution functions, the more the merrier. So let me give you an example here of what it would look like if you add a lot of this world information. You have the different contributions from the quark, from the quark content of the proton. Here is the distribution for valence U quarks. Here's valence D quarks. And then you have the different light seas, including the strange sea, which has quite a large uncertainty, as you can see as you go to lower X. And gluons dominate at very low X. And here's gluon distribution divided by 10, because otherwise it'd be so far off. And this is at a scale where you're talking about 10 GeV. This is a scale which is more like LHC type scales, which is 10 to the 4 GeV squared. So you can see the precision that you get by putting all of these things together. Just a little, I'm going to spend a few minutes to talk about Hera, because I haven't had much opportunity to talk about Hera. And Hera really was the queen of parton distribution functions. And they played an incredible role because they provided us with the very first parton distribution functions that LHC could first use when it did its first measurement. And then the LHC started collecting data, and then it got to improve what really are the parton distributions that then fed in into later measurements. But to start off with, they did, for years, wonderful measurements of parton distribution functions. So they made measurements of things called structure functions. So basically you have, here's your little diagram here, a little Feynman diagram. You have the El Niño that describes the emission of your, either your photon or your Z or your W. And then the W mu nu is what describes the basically the structure of the proton here. And you can work out the formulas into all of this, but I just wanted to break this down into the sort of the two types of structure functions. You have the structure functions that come out of the neutral current processes, the ones that come out of the charge current processes. And you can see that depending on whether you're talking about photons or Zs that are being exchanged, and the combinatorics basically of that, you can see that you have sensitivity to the strange quark, the C quarks here, or the difference between the quarks and the C quarks. But from all of this here, I guess maybe the bottom line in all of this is the lower Q squared neutral current data is able to constrain the low X C quark distribution. So overall, the low X C quark distributions, but it has a lot of difficulty in distributing and distinguishing between the quark flavors of the C, or between any kind of down type quarks at any X. So it has difficulties telling the difference between a D bar and S bar. If you take differences between neutral current and charge current, at high Q squared, together with other high Q squared charge current information, you're able to constrain U valence and D valence. And the Q squared dependence gives you the information about the gluon distribution. This is the data set that came out. And yes, the error bars are on the points. So it really is beautiful. So, okay. In red is what Hera brought to the universe. The colored ones, remember this is sort of lower Q squared, lower X. These are mostly the fixed target experiments that I showed you in this kinematic phase space, which also brought a lot of information. But really, it was exquisite. I mean, there's no other word for it. It was really exquisite. This is F2, so this is these ones over here, okay? And on the right-hand side, it was much harder to measure the F3s, but you can also see that there's some sensitivity there. So Hera used all their neutral current and charge current information. They started off the time working with structure functions, and then later on they evolved to a slightly different nomenclature, which were cross-sections. Reduced cross sections, but there's a relationship between the two to determine the proton, quark, and gluon distribution function. So basically, they did the same ideas I showed you here. They took all their information, they had some parameterization of how they thought the partons were distributed in the proton, and then they extracted an overall parton distribution functions. And this is the results that they would get out of it. You can see the shape of the U and U valence and D valence. This always populates the high X, right? Because the valence quarks carry the largest fraction of the momentum of a proton. When you go to lower x, now you're starting to explore C quarks and gluons. Now, before I show you what happens when you add the data from Hera to the data from the LHC, let me just say a few words about Canadian participation in Hera. Again, it's a Canadian moment. So Canada actually played a quite important role in just the birth of Hera. It contributed to the proton accelerator complex. So here I have a little accelerator complex diagram here. So imagine that this big thing, not very good. You imagine a big circle, which doesn't go off the screen, but imagine you have a big circle, which is Hera. And then just like at the LHC, you have these series of accelerators that sort of boost up the energy of the particles until they reach Hera. So you start off with negatively charged H minus ions. You accelerate them basically to 50 MeV in a linear accelerator. And then you you inject it into the first little collider, which was called DAISY 3. That was accelerated to 7 GeV. Then it was transferred to Petra, which is the larger circle here, accelerated to 40 GeV, and then injected into Hera, which then accelerated the whole thing to 920 GeV. So there was a proposal from the Canadian funding agencies to contribute to this accelerator chain at DAISY. So it was a collaboration between Chalk River that worked on proton radio frequency cavities. And the role of them was actually to capture the proton bunches that were injected in Petra. So you capture them so that they can then be injected into Hera. Triumph worked on the H minus LINAC, so the accelerator there, working on magnets and et cetera. Now, out of all of this, Canada was the first country that was funded for this project. This is a project in Germany. So Canada was the first one to get funded, which then led to Germany agreeing to have a German facility. And eventually there were 11 countries that participated in there. So it was really a first major contribution by Canada to an international accelerator that actually existed after it made contributions. And the date here is in 1983. You can see from the proposal to participate in Hera. So long ago, the photos were in black and white. This is a photograph of equipment that was provided by Triumph in 1986. Now, this is a cheat, of course, because we did have color photography in 1986. I definitely remember color photography at that time, but in any case, it was a black and white photography. The magnets were made by a company called K&S Tool and Die, located in Winnipeg. So Winnipeg actually built some of these magnets that were then shipped to Germany and used in the accelerator. Ah, look at this wonderful. See, proof that there was color photography in the 80s. So that was contribution to Hera, to the accelerator. But of course, if you're going to contribute to the accelerator, you want to contribute to one of the experiments that's actually going to do the physics off the accelerator. And Canada joined, the first experiment that it joined there was Zeus. And it joined in 1982, 2 years before the experiment was formally approved to be an experiment. It was a contribution between Manitoba, McGill, Toronto, and York. So actually here you see, this is a photograph of the DAISY director at the time in 1984 having a speech saying, yes, we approve having this experiment. And I only do it really because I want to show you this awesome flag in the background, just to prove that's there. All right, so the Zeus group got funded. And they wanted to build a calorimeter, like we've been talking about, one of those sampling calorimeters. It was a uranium calorimeter and scintillator. There was no space at the university to build this, no lab space. So, you know, pioneer spirit of physicists. Pioneer spirit of the physicist. Hello. Maybe the bulb that, no, there's light up there. Oh. Something going on. Aww. What's going on? So clearly there's, I don't know if it timed out or, oh, there we go. All right, good. You know, in those days, we didn't care about safety. You know, we didn't have to work, you know, only 40 hours a week. We worked 40 hours a day and we loved it, okay? But no, so really what, they couldn't find any space in the university, so they just found some empty warehouse in the suburb of Toronto and decided to build their detector there. So that's what they did. This is the crew from that era. I don't know if you might recognize, oh, Cliff is gone. Cliff might recognize a few faces from the 1980s. The only person who today looks exactly in this photo is this person here. This is David Hanna, if any of you from McGill, you know him from McGill? Dave Hanna is a prof at McGill. He looks today like he did then. I mean, if you ever read Portrait of Dorian Gray, you know, something's going on there. So they contribute to the calorimeter, but also to the trigger system. There was another experiment at HERA that had Canadian contributions. That there, it was the polarized deep inelastic scattering, Hermes. It was a founding member of Hermes. It came just after the letter, LOIs means letter of intent. So normally when you want to build a new experiment or a new facility, you write a formal letter, which is usually a few hundred pages, that said, my letter of intent, I intend to build something. And then you present it to the authorities. And then they get it reviewed, and then either you get approved or you don't get approved. Approval for Hermes came in 1982. You can see here the core team of the people. It was all Triumph originally that started at Hermes. Here is actually the official notification. This was, it's handwriting. And it says, two spokesmen, you can see in those days, of the Hermes collaboration. To be fair, they were both spokesmen and not spokespersons. Dear colleagues, I am pleased to inform you that the DAISY directive has today conditionally approved Hermes experiment following the recommendations of the PRC. It's a review committee. This approval is subject to a clarification of the contribution of the Hermes experiment and the funds something something. We're looking forward to an exciting physics program, blah, blah, blah. So this is this person's letter basically saying congratulations. This collaboration grew. And one of the things that they really did was they built a transition radiation detector. This is something that is very helpful to measure. So, you know, when a particle goes through matter, you can have transition radiation just as it goes through the different materials that are there. And that helps you to tell it apart, like an electron from a pion. So, for example, this detector was very good to tell the two apart. It was about $1 million project. Smaller scope, but it was fun. Okay, now I can go back. If you have all the HERA information and now you start having all the LHC information, you want to put it all together and get the absolute best measurement of parton distribution functions that you can possibly get. So your starting point in this is you just take at face value everything that came out of HERA. So here it is. And these are the contributions to the total chi-squared of the fit. So you can see how much each of the different contributions add up to the total chi-squared, which had 1,620 degrees of freedom. So you can see here in Atlas, W and Z measurements that I mentioned, I didn't mention here, but also photon production is sensitive to parton distribution functions. TT bar production, production of jets, etc. And then you parameterize everything, again, in terms of your prejudice, basically, how you think the quarks and the gluons are distributed. And out of that comes the total chi-squared, and you get the total fits that come out of that. So on the top is the U-valence distribution, and yes, there are error bars. You can only really see them sort of when you start taking ratios. This is valence U, this is CU, the quark C. You can see very beautiful, very precise. I showed you this plot before. This is what happens when you don't use WZ information and when you do use WZ information. But this is another cool one. This is the difference between the light C D bar and the light C U bar. Now that's very hard to measure because D bar, U bar, they're quite similar. And it's one of the things that are still kind of controversial out there, whether or not you would expect D bar and U bar to be the same, or they would expect them to be different. And you can see if you don't use measurements of V plus jet production, for example, which are quite sensitive to this, you have one shape. And then if you use all the information, the shape completely flips. So at this level, I would say, we're not quite sure yet what is D bar minus U bar. But you can see that adding information really can constrain things. Yes?
Why would it make sense that the valence quark distribution is higher at low x, according to the first plot?
Higher at low x, yeah. So you have to sort of think about the proton. Let's think about very reductionist. What's a proton? Very reductionist, you would say it has three valence quarks. So each one of them carries, very reductionist, 1/3 of the proton momentum on average. All right, so that's your 1/3. That would be around here somewhere, 1/3.
It's going to be higher at higher x,
actually. So at higher x, mostly carried by the valence quarks, and just by doing back of the envelope, on average, the valence quark carry 1/3. As you go to low x, you start having a lot of C quarks, and then there the C quarks can carry more of the momentum information at low x. So seeing all of this, I already said it, I'll maybe say it one last time. If you want to understand everything that you do at the LHC, the first thing you need to know is make sure you understand the protons that you're using to collide with. All right. So that was Z information, how it feeds into parton distribution. I also want to mention a few things about Z production because Zs can be a significant background to other stuff, right? If you're looking for new particles, sometimes the new particle that you're looking for can be kind of Z-like. I want to bring back this nice picture here. This is the invariant mass of 4 leptons. This is a distribution that I showed, I think, before. You use to look for the Higgs boson. Here's the Higgs boson in the 4 lepton final state. And all of this stuff underneath here are Z bosons, not coming from the Higgs. And looking at this, you might say, hey, look, there's another particle here. Cool, you know, I'm discovering a new particle. And then you look at the mass and you go, wait a second, that's 90 GeV. Do I know a particle that's 90 GeV? Oh, yeah, it's the Z boson. But normally the Z boson decays into 2 leptons, but it's very easy, well, not very easy, but it's certainly possible to make a Z boson out of 4 leptons. And I'll show you the Feynman diagram for that in a moment. So if you want to understand, if you want to be able to measure how many Higgs bosons you've seen, you need to understand, for example, how much of this peak sort of falls underneath the Higgs boson, and also how much of this falls underneath there. So here are the diagrams where you have a Z boson, or at least one Z boson, decaying and producing 4 leptons in the final state. So here I have a Z, you have 2 leptons, one of them radiates a Z, which again decays, and so you're left with 4 leptons, all originating from a first Z. Okay, this is a virtual Z here, and this is a non-shell Z. Another way that you can produce four leptons, of course, is if you have two Zeds and each of them decay into two leptons. So this is the plot I showed you a second ago. So we're looking at this peak here. This is what it looks like when you have an analysis that's really dedicated to the measurement of the Higgs boson. But if you wanted to know what's in this plot here, you should instead make a measurement that is dedicated to what's happening in this peak here. And this is what it comes out in this one. So this is an analysis whose role was not to measure the Higgs boson, but whose role was really dedicated to measure the Z decaying to four leptons. So you take that peak, you sort of stretch it out a little bit, and you can see what it looks like. Sure enough, it's about 90 GeV. So it really is the Z boson. So I want to use this to just walk you through a cross-section measurement so you can see all the elements that go into a cross-section measurement. So we're going to take this peak and measure its cross-section. You ready? All right. Because CERN's in Switzerland, I'm going to do the cross-section with cows. I want to tell you the difference between reconstructed cows, fiducial cows, and total cows.
Spherical cows.
There, yeah, I quite like the reconstructed cow, but yeah. All right, the first thing you need to know before we do any kind of measurement, you design an analysis strategy. Right? You say, okay, I'm looking for Z. The first thing I would do if I'm looking for Z, well, if I'm looking for Z decaying to two leptons, I expect to have two prompt leptons. Prompt meaning if I were to take my electron and my muon and trace it back, it seems to come really from the interaction point and not from some other particle that traveled for a while and then decayed. For example, a tau lepton. A tau you can produce Z to tau tau. The tau will travel for a little bit and noticeable distance, and then it will decay into, for example, an electron or muon. And so you want to make sure you don't pick up accidentally taus. So you want to make sure as best as you can that the leptons were really produced from the Z. So it's prompt production. The leptons should be isolated, meaning the leptons shouldn't have other stuff nearby. You know, because if it's a Z, you should have two leptons. It shouldn't be too busy around there. So you want to look at how isolated your lepton is, and it's a charged lepton. If it's coming from a Z, you expect, well, they have to be the same flavor. Unless you do lepton flavor violation measurements, which we do at ATLAS, you're looking for Z decaying to two electrons or two muons. You don't look for Z decaying to an electron and a muon. And finally, they should have opposite sign because the Z is neutral. If you're producing two leptons, you have two different signs. Okay, so let's talk about leptons. The leptons get reconstructed in my detector within the pseudo-rapidity and transverse momentum ranges afforded by the detector. What does that mean? It means my detector woke up and saw, hey, there's a lepton. Now, the detector only wakes up when I tell it to wake up. And I don't want to wake up too often because there's so much junk in the production of proton-proton collisions. So I say, only wake up if you see two leptons and each of them are at least 15 GeV. So that's what it means by transverse momentum PT afforded by the detector. The detector doesn't really look in the situation for very low momentum PT, very low PT leptons. In any case, very low PT leptons would not come from a Z boson anyway, so that's fine. Pseudorapidity afforded by the detector. Remember, the detector, it is not everywhere in space. It's chunks of things, right? And down close to the beamline, there's no instrumentation. Remember, there's a barrel, there's an end cap, there are cracks. So basically, you can only measure leptons where there's a detector for it to measure it. So that means by the pseudorapidity afforded by the detector. So this is what is called the fiducial phase space. What it is you use the kinematic variables that kind of sculpt the selection that I made. So basically, I decided that I'm only going to look at leptons at least 15 GeV. I'm only going to look at leptons that have an eta that is within my detector, and so on and so on. So that is the fiducial phase space. So we're going from reconstructed and fiducial to fiducial. One other thing. If I see a lepton in my detector and I'm measuring it, my detector's not perfect. It has inefficiencies associated to it. So nature might have given me a 27.5 GeV electron, but my detector said, nah, it's 26. And so what you need to do is take what you reconstruct and unfold it to what nature really told, well, what really the lepton's energy was. And you need Monte Carlo to do that. Once I correct for the imperfections of my detector, and I tell you what is the phase space of my detector, the phase space of my detector, I can measure a cross-section there. And this is a perfectly good cross-section, because if you think about it, I've unfolded all the experimental uncertainty inefficiencies. And as long as I tell you what is the size of my detector, this is a number that you can use and compare it to phenomenology. So this is my fiducial. It's the cow, but a minimalist cow, where it's the cow where you exactly measure what you see from the detector. The other total cow is, I'm going to extrapolate my fiducial cow to what would it look like if I had a perfect detector everywhere. So all the bits and pieces of phase space that I can't see because my detector has limitations, I'm going to extrapolate to that phase space. And that can only be done by predictions. You know, either you have a calculation or you have Monte Carlo that goes to the full phase space. So I'm going to walk through the calculations related to that. Phenomenologists love the full phase space. They love the total cross-section because it's really easy to measure, to compare to their predictions. I hate the full phase space because I have to introduce theoretical uncertainties when I go from my fiducial to the total, because I need some Monte Carlo to tell me what the full phase space is, the bits that my detector doesn't see. So it's actually the measurement that is closest to what my detector is the fiducial. All right, and even at that, there's all kinds of fun complications when I say, okay, just a second. When you see an electron, what do you mean I saw an electron? Did I see my electron before it radiates a photon? So that's a Born level. Are we talking about electrons after they radiate? Or, and there's another definitive cross-section, which is called dress, where you take the electron and all the little photons that you might expect near the electron, to try and account for all the possible radiation. And it makes a big difference because this energy is different than this energy because of photons radiated, is different again from this energy because this one is closer to this one in this case. You had a question.
Yeah. What are the largest backgrounds that you can worry about when it comes to the direction of two leptons?
Very little. And in fact, we're going to see that in two slides from now. Two leptons is very, very easy. Okay, here we go. All of this in one equation. Here's the equation for a cross-section. And then all the factors that go in. Okay, the first factor that goes in is the number of candidate events. In my experiment, I count how many things that I think look like a Z boson. Some of them really are Z bosons. And some of them, they're sneaky background events. They slip in, they kind of look like a cow. But if you look at them really carefully, they're not really a cow. So I need to evaluate the non-cowness of my cow. They're called background events, and then subtract them out. So really what you have here is a counting. It's literally a counting part of the experiment. 1, 2, 3, 4, and I subtract the background. And always you need to normalize to the luminosity, meaning how good was the LHC at delivering collisions in the first place? So that's this L over here. Then we have the two correction factors. The one is the correction factor that takes me from the reconstruction phase space to the fiducial phase space, right? That takes me from this cow to this cow. That's C. And if I want to go from the fiducial to the total, then I have another factor here called A. That's the acceptance. This is just for one quantity. You're measuring a cross-section. You can, of course, measure this in two or three dimensions or five dimensions, whatever. But then it gets, of course, a lot more complicated because you have correlations between the different quantities. All right, so let's go through the measurement of this. So this is the cross-section coming from this measurement here. Now that you understand all the elements that come to it. So the very easiest cross-section that I could measure is how many cow-like objects that I saw over the period of time that I did the measurement. So let's say the 8TV, I saw 151 cow-like objects. So 16 of them were the 1z decays to 2 electrons, the other z to the 2 electrons, or 2 mu to mu, or 1 decay to an electron and 1 to muon, or 1 to muon to an electron. So you add them all up, it's 151. Here is your question. How many sneaky groundhogs sort of sneak in? It's very clean sample. The estimate is only one of those 151 in this case would come from background sources. So this is very clean. So that's your next best guess as to what the cross-section is. You take the number of cow-like objects, you subtract the background, and divide by the normalization. So it's very clean, actually, in this case. All right, now we're going to talk about the C factor. This is the correction factor to go from reconstructed to truth, basically, to what nature actually provided compared to what I measure. I just want to remind you, remember this lovely picture here when we looked at jets and all these inefficiencies when you go to different crack regions, etc. This is what we're correcting with the C factor. That is what it looks like for jets.
One question.
Yeah.
Excuse me. The previous or the next the C. Yeah.
Sorry.
That C. What kind of efficiency would that be? When you talk about efficiency.
Okay. Right. For example, here. I'll give you examples of efficiencies right here. So here's one of them. This is my efficiency here. There's three curves. Just look at one of them. For example, a red curve here. As a function of the eta, so this is for electron. This is my efficiency at identifying electron. So out of the 100 electrons that might have been produced, I'm able to identify 90% of them. And it is dependent on where I am in my detector because the technology of the detector is different and you have different cracks in various places. But that's one of the efficiencies. So one efficiency is related to how you can reconstruct an object. Another efficiency would be is from the reconstruction, how do you identify it as being the particle that you think that it is? If you decide you want to isolate it, you want to make sure that there's nothing nearby. So that would also have an efficiency, so you would lose events again there. And there's also an efficiency if the detector is going to wake up and take an event, so there's the trigger is inefficient as well. So these are all the efficiencies that fold in. And in a second, I'll tell you what C is actually for this particular measurement. Yeah?
Does the efficiency take into account like both like acceptance and rejection?
Yes, indeed it does. So when we, so you see the three curves, these are actually three set points that we decided on exactly for that. So you can say, depending on the analysis, you could say, an analysis like this, it's actually pretty easy to see a Z boson. So you don't need to be super uptight about having a great efficiency because you know it's easy to measure. And so what you would say is, I'm willing to have, you know, to sacrifice efficiency because I know I have very little background in the first place. But there might be other situations when you say, you know, this is a very tough measurement to make. There are many other things that can look like what I'm doing. Top production, for example, producing electrons. And here I'm going to say, because I have a background that's going to be high, I'm going to be really tight about how efficient I want my electron to be. And that's, for example, the blue curve. You can the black curve. You can see here, I wanted to, for if you use this point, you can see here you have 100% efficiency. Or if you want to really tighten, you want to really, really, really make sure that you have an electron, then you can use a tighter efficiency. All right, so here it is. This is what the C factor is. When you bring in all of the inefficiencies, and also the fact you have four leptons, huh? So you have the inefficiency of one lepton, then the other one, then the other one, then the other one, and they have to all be considered. So it's about 60%. You actually end up losing about 60% of your information just by these correction factors. So that would be the next, did I miss one? Yeah, 60%. So that's the next best measurement that you can make. This is your fiducial cross-section. You've taken the number of events you've observed, you subtracted the background, and you divide by this 60% correction factor. And now you have a real cross-section. This is 12th femtobarn. This is a fiducial cross-section, so I need to tell you this is 12th femtobarn, but my detector is this size, and the minimum PT of each lepton is whatever it is. But it is a perfectly good measurement that you can use for if you want to compare it to phenomenology. I like the fiducial cross-section because that is the number that is the closest to what I measure in my detector, having corrected all known imperfections of my detector. It has very small theoretical uncertainties, not zero, because you do need to use Monte Carlos in some cases for some of the corrections, but it's very small, and the uncertainties that drive this really are related to the experiment, not to theory. Now, if you wanted to extrapolate to the full phase space, meaning you're going in all, the detector would be all-encompassing, you don't have minimum thresholds on how, what is the PT of a lepton. So this is the A factor. This is a factor that has to come entirely from Monte Carlo. This is not something we can measure because I don't have a detector there to measure outside. And A in this case is 12%. So this is now the total cross-section is 107 inverse femtobarn. I'll explain the uncertainties in a second. This is also a perfectly good measurement that you can use in phenomenology, but this will have a theoretical uncertainty associated to it, which is non-negligible.
One question, how do you pass from the sigma fiducial to the other one?
Yep. So I use a Monte Carlo that produces Z bosons in all directions. And then I say, okay, now produce Z bosons only where they would fall inside my detector. And then you take the ratio of the two.
Okay, yeah, I was dividing the numbers to see if I
could. No. So for example, the detector only goes to eta's minus 2.5, plus minus 2.5. So you could just, all this, you don't need reconstruction level. This can all be done with truth Monte Carlo, like, and with no reconstruction, because now we've already corrected out all the inefficiencies and things related to the measurement. Literally, all you need is like a Z gun that would point in all directions and you should measure, okay, how many Zs would I see everywhere and how many of them would actually fall in my detector? Yep.
So to understand this correctly, the correction factor is accounting for how much information you lose?
Yeah, you lose because your detector is imperfect, effectively.
Why does that increase the cross-section? Like it looks like the...
Because I'm correcting to the truth. So it's saying nature gave me... I'm not going to look at the numbers. Nature gave me 100 of them, but I only saw 60 of them. So if I want to correct, I need to divide by the 60% to bring it back to what nature provided to me. So because it's in the denominator, it's not in the numerator. Huh? So you correct back. So basically it's saying I lost 40% of them. That's another way to look at it. And so I correct up to account for the ones that I lost. Yeah.
So what's the difference between electron
plus one? The difference between these two, it's a little bit of a technicality. But what it is in the analysis here, the first one was always the one that had the highest PT. So this is the Z that had the highest PT and it had the electrons. The second Z had a lower PT And this is the category where the highest PT Z had muons and the lower Z had electrons. And you can see for that measurement, we were far more effective at looking for muons than we were for electrons. It's a very early measurement. Okay, just a few words about uncertainties, because of course, with a cross-section, you need uncertainties. This is a statistical, so basically it's a root n type of. The background has a statistical component, but it also has a systematic component that's associated with how you measure the background in the first place. Now, both of these correction factors, C and A, would have theoretical uncertainties, which are not in the table here. And then the final cross-section would be the cross-section that you measure, the statistical uncertainty associated, the experimental uncertainty associated to it, and traditionally, we always split off what is the uncertainty related to the luminosity. And if you start, this is just one number, but if you start doing as a function of various variables, then of course you have to start worrying about how the systematic uncertainties are correlated between the different variables.
And do you also measure correlations between different processes and different?
Yeah, we can, yeah. In fact, more and more now, we try, there's even some analyses that try to measure simultaneously two processes. Like you'll have one process that's the one you're interested in, but the background is so dominant underneath that you might as well measure the background while you're at it, right? And then you extract the two together. So that was just a number. That was the number that corresponds to this red peak. There it is. That's the number we just calculated. Whew. Now, of course, you want to do that for everything. So different invariant masses. Here's the Higgs in blue. But OK, I thought it would be fun to walk you through one measurement so you can understand also the difference between fiducial and total cross-section. If you read papers from Atlas and you see stuff, and you see the word cross-section, I highly recommend that you read the paper really carefully to make sure that it's a total cross-section or a fiducial cross-section, because it can make a big difference on how you can interpret things. And this is just a plot of the various systematic uncertainties that would be associated to the measurement. And this is the one that we just walked our way through here, which had a very low background. Right, so the systematic uncertainty associated to it is very low, and then you can see some of the other uncertainties. So I just did that for one process, which was a Z production, but it's not even this one, it's Z into four leptons. We do this for anything we can find our hands on. Basically, this is a plot of the cross sections for PP going to anything. From PP to PP, or to W's and Z's, and then down somewhere over here, there are the more recent ones, four top. I'll talk about four top in a little bit. And I love this plot, and I call it the Brontosaurus plot, because it does look like a Brontosaurus. I think this plot was shown a little while ago by somebody else, yesterday or the day before. Life gets certainly more interesting if you're going to look at not just at the production of a Z boson, but Z in association with other stuff. It could be in association with jets, for example. And if you look at Z bosons in association with jets, you have all the things that you can learn from a process like that. We've already explored, I think, most of these, right? The hard scattering, which is basically this part here. You can study the parton showers. You can study the fragmentation into jets, the jet composition and the dynamics of the jet, and you can, of course, measure the underlying event here and the parton distribution function. So really, you learn a lot of stuff just from these kinds of measurements. And I'm just going to show you one of each, just so you can see what the challenges are in this. This is the production of Z plus jets. Somebody was asking yesterday how many jets, or 2 days ago, how many jets can we measure in the experiment? A lot. This is Z with at least one jet, two jet, three jets, four jets, five jets, six jets, seven jets. So here we have the production of a Z boson with seven jets. Now, of course, it gets harder and harder to do that. And so this kind of measurement is really important because you use that to tune the various Monte Carlos that are available to us. And unfortunately, the various Monte Carlos, they do different things depending on which Monte Carlo you get, which is another warning to you. If you're just going to pick up a Monte Carlo off the web somewhere and decide to compare it to some measurements, you need to study very carefully what it does, because all these Monte Carlos do very different things. For example, in this plot here, black hat plasura, so this is this one here, the ratio between data and prediction, or prediction to data. This is a Monte Carlo. So it's a generator plus Poisson shower. This is what it means when I have blah plus blah. That is the generator, that is the Poisson shower. So how partons are showered with what? So it's generated with black hat, and it's the Poisson shower with the Sherpa. This one is a Monte Carlo that is parton level at fixed order, so at N and low, up to 4 partons and nothing else. And so you can see that it can give me predictions up to 4 partons, but after that it doesn't make sense to use it for anything else, because it doesn't take care of more than 4 jets in this situation. So you can read the various Monte Carlos and what they do, and they all do different things, and they all end up looking very different compared to the data. And so this is really valuable because, you know, for example, the Sherpa authors who work very closely with us, they love our data because they'll say, oh, wow, look at that. It doesn't agree way up here. Okay, what do I need to tweak in my Monte Carlo to then agree to the data? And then the next time you measure it, it looks beautiful. Or we go to higher number of jets and they realize it's great up to 7 jets, but then it's really lousy after that. Now, W plus jets, I have 2 different plots here. Here, I just want to use W plus jets to show you another important role that these play. W plus jets is actually non-negligible background for a lot of Higgs boson production. So meaning if you're looking for the Higgs boson and you find background, chances are good it's W plus jets, because it looks in some cases very Higgs boson-like. And also in beyond standard model searches. So let me just show you 2 cross-sections and just explain why, when we like to measure this cross-section, we try to do it as a function of as many useful variables as we can. So this measurement that I showed you here, I just showed you as a function of number of jets, but this paper will show it to you as a function of many other variables, because each of these variables have a different sensitivity to different types of physics. So for example, HT is something, it's called the scalar PT, sum of all the visible objects. So you take all the visible objects in your event, you sum the PT in a scalar way, and you would sort of say, well, why do you want to do that? Actually, it ends up being a very sensitive variable. If you're doing BSM searches that that have states that result from the decay of very heavy particles. So this HT is sensitive to those kinds of searches. Or if you have W plus 2 jets, you can study the invariant mass of a 2-jet system. And why would you want to do that? Well, maybe you're looking for beyond standard model searches. You're looking for a new heavy particle that's decaying to 2 jets. And so you study first 2-jet resolution in a plot like this, and then you would apply it to your search for new physics. All right, Higgs boson, W boson. Let me get some water, because this topic needs water. So this fall, CERN is going to be celebrating the 40th anniversary of the direct measurement of W and Z bosons. It was in 1973. That is the plot here of the discovery paper of the W boson from the UA1 experiment, 1983. They had so few events, each one of them had a letter. So this is the transverse mass. I'll explain in a second what that transverse mass is. This is event A. Event B, C, D, E, F. So they had 6 events. And from that 6 events, they, just by looking at the clustering events, and you have to do a detailed analysis to make sure you understand everything, but basically it was the very first measurement of the W boson. It was observation, and they could tell that the W boson was 81 plus or minus 5 GeV. Now, the W boson mass nowadays is still 81. But the uncertainty is much smaller. And that's a great example of that number. That's one of the reasons why in analyses it's called the most probable value. All right, it may move around and stuff as you do a more refined analysis or you get more statistics, but it is the most probable value, and it's one of those most probable values that seems to have stuck. So indeed, the W boson is around that mass even today. So that was at UA1. Remember at LEP, after it studied the Z boson, it was able to get enough energy in the accelerator to make two W bosons. So from those two W bosons, they measured the mass of the W boson. So you can see here, they went from a position of 5 GeV to 50 MeV, which is pretty remarkable. Then at Tevatron, remember the PP bar accelerator, this was their not their first measurement, but let's say it was the measurement before the most recent one that's controversial. So this is from 2014. You can see the shape of the transverse mass. This is the original transverse mass. This is what it looks like when you have bins with 40,000 events in one event and one bin, and very nice agreement. And then, so I'm going to tell you a little bit this story here because it's an interesting story. Atlas made a measurement, which was really cool and kind of agreed with everybody and the standard model. Tevatron, as you saw, made another measurement, which does not agree. And then Atlas remade its measurement, and it still agrees with the standard model. So it's emotional, let's say. Okay, the mass of the W boson. Let me just say a few generalities related. Okay, good, I have a little bit of time. The electroweak sector, the standard model, is very important because it relates various parameters of the standard model, as we saw this morning, in particular the mass of the W, alpha electromagnetic, for example, sine squared theta W. And through the quantum corrections of a W boson, you see that it actually has contributions that depend quadratically on the top mass, and also logarithmically on the mass of the Higgs boson. And in fact, even before the Higgs boson was ever observed, by measuring this thing up here, mass of the W had to be, you know, the insert is about 50 MeV, you can turn this around and say, I measure the mass of the W to be 50 MeV. I believe in the standard model. And if I believe in the standard model, then there's a loop in there that's related to the Higgs boson. And then just the fact that I have such a good precision of the mass of the W, you can turn it around and say, if the standard model is correct, I can give a good guess as to where the Higgs boson would be. And it was actually reasonably precise. The current best predictions, standard model predictions, for the masses of the W, the precision is about 8 MeV nowadays. So if you want to do something that is comparable to the theoretical uncertainties, you want experimental measurements that are on that scale. The extraction of the mass of the W at hadron colliders, or anywhere actually, it's quite a challenging thing. It's not like the beautiful Z boson. It's the W boson. The case we use that channel, it's a decay to a lepton and a neutrino, and the neutrino is unobserved. So it's not like you can fully reconstruct the final state. So we use, as I explained, the transverse plane to balance things. And these are the most recent measurements. So I want to spend just a moment talking about the topology of the event, because you will see how we go about mitigating this annoyance, the fact that we cannot fully reconstruct the W boson. Thank goodness that Mother Nature gave us a Z boson. So let's look at the production of a Z boson, or it could also be a W boson, doesn't matter, in this picture here. So in the transverse plane, you have some Z boson or W boson with certain PT. And then to balance out, because you know the net sum of the momenta needs to be zero, you need to have, it's recoiling off of something. So this is called the hadronic recoil. Now in the Z boson, this is kind of cool. This is a cool trick, is that you can measure the PT of the Z because it's a fully reconstructed final state. And you can cross-check that PT by measuring the PT of the hadronic recoil. And they better equal each other because, you know, the sum of the momentum needs to be zero. So maybe you can see where I'm going at. You can use the Z boson to see how well the hadronic recoil describes the PT of the Z. So you validated all on this thing. I measure this, and they better be equal. And then I do the same thing for the W. So literally, I take the information that I learned from the hadronic recoil, and I say, okay, now what happens if instead of having a Z, I have a W? The W is not fully reconstructed, but this hadronic recoil I can reconstruct. So even though the W has a part that escapes, by measuring the recoil, I can figure out what the PT of the W was, even though. So it's kind of a cool trick, right? Even though I can't see all of my W, I can see everything that recoils. And I test this using the Z boson. This is the definition here of W transverse mass. We can't really measure the mass of the W because an important part of it escapes, the neutrino. So what it's effectively like, what is the mass as measured in the transverse plane, which is kind of a weird quantity because, of course, mass is a scalar, it's not a vector. But this is the formal definition. So it's called the transverse mass. And you can see in this plot here, this is the transverse mass. This is, again, the transverse mass. So we measure the transverse mass and not the mass of the W. All right, let me say a few words about the role of the Z. You can see why it's very cool. As I mentioned on the last slide here, I use events like this to try and understand what it means to have a hadronic recoil and see if I can understand what is the transverse momentum of this object just by looking at what it recoiled off of. So I do that with my Z. Another useful thing you can do, well, here's my Z. It decayed into two leptons. I can mimic a W boson this way by, wink, wink, pretending I don't see that electron. If I pretend I don't see that electron, doesn't it just look like a W boson, except that's a mass of 90 GeV and this is a mass of 80 GeV. So I can do all my tests, everything, on a fully reconstructed state. And then the information that I learn here, I can carry over to the W. So it's not a big deal that I don't see the neutrino and the W, because I do everything with my Z first. And then, of course, I need to carry over that information. There are some uncertainties associated with carrying from one to the other. I mean, it's not the same particle, but it does go a long way. All right, so let's talk a little bit about how you would get W mass out of this. Here is for a W decaying to a lepton. This is the transverse mass of the lepton. This is all simulation. I just want to show you how this transverse mass would change if the W were 50 MeV heavier than what it was in the Monte Carlo, or 50 MeV lighter. Now, these curves are superposed. You can't really see, so it looks like it's very small distortions. If you take the ratio, this is the ratio of what this plot would look like if MW is, I don't know what they used here, maybe let's call it 80 GeV, or if it were 80 GeV plus 50 MeV, or 80 GeV minus 50 MeV. And these are the level of differences we're trying to measure to see the sensitivity. So basically, the mass of the object is going to shape how you see the kinematic variables. And effectively, what we do is, because we don't have infinite time to produce infinite number of Monte Carlos, we usually produce one Monte Carlo at one central value of the mass of the W. And then we take the Monte Carlo and we reweight it to different masses, like what would it look like if the mass were a little bit more, or a little bit more, or a little bit more. Basically, we use a Bright Wigner to reweight original Monte Carlo to various hypotheses of what the mass of the W could be. Now, all of this depends very much on how you model this distribution, which I'll show a little bit in a second. We use two variables that are sensitive to the W mass, the PT of the lepton and the transverse mass. And we do this in the two decay modes, electron and muon decay modes. And because there are two charges to the W, we can do it separately for W plus and separately for W minus. And then we have a number of categories. Basically, we just break up the detector in different components, different parts, and then we measure the mass of the W independently whether, for example, the lepton fell here in the detector, or the lepton fell here in the detector, or the lepton fell here in the detector. There are some good reasons to do that. First of all, you're measuring independently three different times, the mass of the W, but also the detector reacts differently in different places. So really, it's kind of nice to measure it in different regions of the detector technology, basically. All right, so we need to model this. So you need to use a Monte Carlo and then reweight this Monte Carlo to different hypotheses for the mass of the W. But we never have a Monte Carlo that agrees terribly well with our data. So we need to massage a Monte Carlo. You take the Monte Carlo and then you improve it. So I've done a very perverse decomposition of cross sections. This is the Drellian cross section, you know, production of a W. So I have a component here, which is the two-dimensional cross section, this function of PT and rapidity. And that it's the inverse of that, this one here. And then I multiply it by the cross section as function of rapidity and the cross section of function of mass. And I'll explain in a second why I do that. And then there's this other component here, which is something that is never talked about. But actually, there was a really beautiful measurement that was done of this. Remember in first year quantum mechanics, remember Clebsch-Gordan tables? The many great homework assignments. You have two spin one-half particles, quarks, decaying to a spin one particle, a W, decaying to two spin one-half particles, leptons. You get all the YLMs that come out of that? This is what this term is. It's basically the YLMs of a two spin one-half going to a spin one, going to two spin one-half. So it's really testing how basically the fundamental process that's happening. Okay, so we decompose it in this weird way. And the reason we do that is the central part here, we use our workhorse, which is called the Pythia 8 Monte Carlo. So basically, it's this Monte Carlo that you see kind of here. And we improve it a little bit. We can tweak the parameters of this Monte Carlo to agree better with some of the things we've observed in our data. So we tweak the parton shower part in particular. So it's Pythia 8 is the parton showers. So it's Monte Carlo tweaked to improve better description of our data. This part here, the cross section is function of rapidity, we validate with measurements. So we measure that cross section. Here, for example, an example of that cross section here. As a function of here pseudo rapidity, but basically here's the measurement of W plus production. Here it is, W minus production, and you compare it to the prediction. So you validate that this is good. These YLMs here, we also made a measurement of that. That's in black, and we validate the Monte Carlo that we use to make sure that the Monte Carlo is not so far off. And then the green part here is just we use a Breitwittner to do that. Now, there are a number of uncertainties associated with all this, because this is all modeling, right? It's modeling validated with data. And there are all kinds of uncertainties associated to it. For example, the choice of the parton distribution functions that you might have used in your Monte Carlo. Your Monte Carlo never goes to high enough orders. So it's the effects of missing higher orders these are next to next-to-leading order predictions. Contributions from heavy quarks in the Monte Carlo. So these are all things that are uncertainties that you have to take into account when you do the measurement. These are theoretical uncertainties that are associated with a measurement. All right. Now, this is a slide just to go through the experimental considerations, because that was all the theoretical consideration. The experimental considerations. Here's the plot again. And how could this plot go wrong from an experimental point of view? We've been talking about efficiencies, so we need to correct for all those efficiencies. That C factor that I was talking about for the cross section, we need to correct here as well. So we have inefficiencies on triggering on this, on triggering. Whatever. Triggering. On reconstructing the particles, on identifying them, on isolating them. when we measure the energy of the particle, we could be wrong by a little bit. So maybe we have uncertainties on the energy scale or the momentum scale. We have uncertainties related to the resolution, so how well we measure the energy and momentum, maybe other kinds of biases. Now, these are all things you don't want to do on the W sample because that's what you're using to measure the mass of the W. So you don't want to really test all that on the W. But no worries. Who comes to the rescue? My faithful dog, Zeddy. All right. So I do all this stuff on Zeddy, my dog, and the Mu Mu and the electron channel. So I do all these fixes. And then I look at my Z and I compare it to my prediction. And you can see that it's pretty good, right? And the places that count, which is the bulk of it, okay, it's not perfect. There are places. And wherever it's not perfect, you have to count systematic uncertainties for it. So I do all of that with the Z. And then I transfer the knowledge that I did the Z to the W.
Excuse me.
Yep.
One question. When you compute all of those efficiencies,
yeah.
You're relying on the standard model.
Yes, yes, absolutely. We rely on the standard model.
How could it change in some regions of space if we consider that there might be a hidden sector?
Yeah, yeah. So it is, what it does is you measure it, first of all, with well-known processes, like the Z boson, and it you can only really, the best places where you can do it is only in the kinematic phase space afforded by the process you're using to calibrate it. So for example, for Z bosons, I can do it from a lepton PT of about 15 GeV to maybe 100 GeV, something like that. And if you're going outside that, so if you're going into little corners of phase space, then you have to make sure you have a healthy systematic to be able to account for things that you don't know about, so you extrapolate. Now, fortunately, when you go to really, really high energies or weird quarters of phase space, usually the experimental systematics are not the things that dominate what you're measuring anyway. Usually it's statistics. So even if you put in 100% uncertainty, it still has no impact on the search that you're doing, or little impact. So one last element, remember, the W decays to a lepton and neutrino. I can't see the neutrino. Darn, how am I going to know what is the transverse momentum of the W? Well, you look at what it recoils against, and you measure what recoils against. So here is a distribution of the recoil as measured from Z. So we measure it from Z. So we test again everything with the Z. This is the recoil of the Z. The two different components, so the longitudinal component of the recoil, U perp, and the transverse component of the recoil. And I test everything here on the Z. And once I'm satisfied that I understand the recoil on the Z, I just then apply that and for the recoil of the W. And that's how I can get the PT of the W. All right, this is it. These are our distributions. After all of these corrections, in blue is the model, you know, the tweaked model, everything that we did here. The data are the points. You can see the ratio underneath. The gray band is the uncertainty associated. And you see all your points kind of fall within the gray band, which is really good. That means that you understand the shape. And if you understand the shape, then you can use this to understand how much the shape is skewed, and hence what is the value of the mass of the W. This is the mass of the W measured. Let me just take one of them. Let me take just the blue ones, because all the blue ones are measured from this distribution, and all the red ones are measured from transverse mass. So let's just take the blue ones, because they're all completely independent. All of these blue measurements are completely independent of each other. This is the mass of the W in this phase space here. If it's pointing up, it's a W plus. If it's pointing down, it's a W minus. So these are two independent measurements of the mass of the W, assuming that the mass of the W is the same for plus and minus, which is something we test actually in this measurement. So these are all independent measurements of the mass of the W. Those are all the uncertainties that go behind this measurement. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I did break them down into colored boxes so you can sort of see, for example, the top purple box. These are all the uncertainties associated with higher order electroweak corrections. In red up there are the uncertainties associated to the QCD model that we used. The two middle blocks are the experimental uncertainties associated to the identification of leptons. And this is the uncertainty associated to the recoil and to the background. And one thing that you can see, the bottom line is the recoil uncertainties, and for example, some of the experimental uncertainties, and up here some of the QC, they're all kind of comparable to each other. So it's not like you can say it's all small except for this uncertainty, which really is really big. But if you put it all together, you have 19 MeV. We recently reanalyzed this measurement, not to improve the experimental aspects of it, which didn't change at all. But since we had done the original measurement, we got a lot better at doing fitting. So we improved the fitting technique. So we use a profile likelihood. I think we used just a chi-squared before. What really changed is our understanding of PDFs, because all this data, beautiful data, has come in since then to shape our understanding of the parton distribution functions. And this is the measurements. Assuming, okay, you use parton distributions coming from this, I mean, parton distributions come from companies now, basically, right? It's like you go on Amazon and you order a PDF. So CT is a company, basically, and they measure parton distribution functions based on world data. MMHT, MSHT, and then PDF. These are all outfits, basically, that look at world data and it extract. And you can see that just by looking at the parton distribution functions, the measurement does change, related to the parton distribution functions. So that's kind of the sensitivity of the parton distribution functions. So we redid all of this. We ended up changing the central value that we used to CT18, which better described our data. And the bottom line when we did all of this is the central value changed a little bit. The uncertainty got a little bit smaller. Remember, it was 19, now it's 16. And this is, before I talk about this one, because this is the controversial one, let me talk about this plot. This is the plot where on this axis is the W mass measurement. On this axis is the best top mass measurement at the moment. The orange are 68 and 95% confidence level when you take the two measurements together. And in gray here is the standard model electroweak fit. So you can see that the measurements of both top mass and W mass are in excellent agreement with the standard model. So now we go to this plot here. You can see this was the mass of the W as measured at LEP. So these two measurements are at Tevatron. The other experiment at Tevatron, which I didn't really mention, says D0. They have a measurement that is an agreement standard model. LHCb, one of the other experiments at the LHC, has a mass of the W. CMS doesn't have one yet. This is our old measurement. This is our new measurement. This is the line of the standard model. And then here's our friends at CDF. And this is a source of great controversy. Before we go to the source of great controversy, I thought I'd show you a cool, you wanna see a nice video? This is a live event, well, not live, but you know, a cool event display. Yeah, that's right, the LHC is running. No, it's not running today, actually, but all right, here we go. So here we go, there's a proton coming in, bang! Here's your muon coming out, and the dashed line is the missing transverse energy. And then all the other stuff is all the other stuff that's produced underneath the W. So let me just run that through you one more time. So all the other tracks that come from the underlying event and all the other stuff that might happen underneath. Each of these little blocks is a little bit of energy deposited in our calorimeter. And because it's a muon, it came all the way out. It didn't leave any energy really in the calorimeter. And then the dotted line is our transverse mass. Transverse missing energy. So let me just say a few words. I'm almost done. Let me just say a few words about CDF. It came with a first measurement, as I think I showed you at the beginning, in around 2014. It used three sensitive variables, transverse mass, transverse energy, for example, the lepton, and also missing transverse energy, and a methodology that's really not terribly different from what ATLAS does. When it did the measurements, CDF came out with a measurement of 19 MeV, Tevatron 16 MeV, and you put it all together, the world average at that time was 15 MeV. And you can see where the systematic, well, the total sources of uncertainties were. Still, they were very much dominated by the W boson statistics, but also PDFs played a really important role. This is the most recent measurement that they did, where they really brought a lot more data in. Before, for example, CDF had 2.2 inverse femtobarns of data, and now they have 8.8, so they're factor four more. These are the same distributions now, but with all of this new data added on top. Here is the measurement that they made. When you compare this plot to this other plot, you can see that there's an art associated to how you want to present your data. See, a plot like this looks like they're very isolated from the standard model. But a plot like this looks like, hey, they kind of agree with the standard model. But the bottom line is these are the two most precise measurements. This is the standard model. This is 7 sigma. I think it's 3 or 4 sigma, the difference between the two. And the other thing is if you now look at a plot of where they sit in the MTMW parameter space, this is the standard model. This is what LEP2 and the Tevatron, so this is their measurements up here, and their measurements fall right here. So it is 7 standard model, 7 standard deviations different from the standard predictions. Big worry. I mean, why worry, huh? No big deal, okay. Either they're right, and there's new physics, but it has to be very special new physics. It's new physics that was seen at the Tevatron, but not at Atlas. Now, of course, the production mechanisms are a little bit different, so, but it's very hard to understand. I mean, it's also inconsistent with D0, which is the other experiment at that collider, although not as precise. So at the moment, in fact, we are working, I mean, with all these people, well, not all these people, but certainly with, they didn't put the LHCb on this one. Let's go back to this one. We are actually working with Atlas, LHCb, and Tevatron to try and create a world combination of all of these. What comes out if you have a world combination? I mean, can you even have a world combination? And it's really hard to have a world combination when you have points that are not, I mean, a chi-squared of points that are not consistent with each other is a bogus chi-squared. So it's really, it's revealing a lot of interesting physics behind all of this, but we are trying to see where these things come from. Is it experimental or is it real? I don't know. And so we're looking very much forward, actually, to CMS. CMS is trying to also make a measurement of the mass of the W, and it'll be one more point to try and understand where all this comes from. This is where I'm going to stop today. Thank you. All right.